Welcome to ATS Mix.
And I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
But also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
Well, I know that this interview that we're going to be doing here, Dave, is something that you've been thinking about doing for quite a while, and I can't be happier that you finally were able to nail down our guest to be able to follow through with this original concept that you have. Why don't you tell everybody what that is?
Well, you know, I have a kind of a military family, if you will, besides the ATS Mix thing,
right,
that I developed with military.com, which is a site that's strictly all military, and it's just got some great people, and I've really become friends with a lot of people over there, and a lot of the forum administrators and a lot of the forum moderators, but especially the members that are at military.com. And there was a post that was made about 2 months ago, and they were talking about back in the Vietnam era of the Air America campaigns and all these things that were going on. And there was this conversation going back and forth, and I don't remember whether it was the Army, Marines, or the Air Force, but I think it was one of the three. And in the course of the conversation, they said, boy, it would be neat to have someone that was involved in that campaign and yada, yada, yada. So I jumped in with my two cents and said, hey, I know somebody that was involved in the campaign. And so, boy, they said, whoa, we'd love to have an interview and hear, you know, firsthand about it. And then, of course, you know, I mentioned it to you. And, of course, at the time, we were heading into the holidays, and we just had a buttload of things to get done, and we never really got around to it. But yeah, I'm really happy that we were able to get our guest, John Lear, and have him consent to doing the show, which we're calling the John Lear CIA Chronicles, because it's basically only about the CIA and his involvement in the Air America / Continental Air campaigns that were going on in Cambodia and Laos and some of the nether regions. And I was blown away by the stories. I know you were too.
Absolutely. In fact, it's an amazing feat in the post-production department that we're going to be able to bring a week-long interview down to over an hour. Yeah.
But I'm telling you, I never laugh so much. And anytime we have Lear on the show, I always laugh my butt off because he just comes up with some stuff, and we're not going to ruin it. But I'm telling you, there's a revelation
that probably has never, ever been publicly known from what we understand.
And even though we did do a disclaimer in the show, we have to make a disclaimer that we under no shape, form, or fashion have anything to do, nor do we agree with any position that John Lear says about certain things, and you'll know when it comes to it. And that definitely goes for the Above TopSecret.com family as well as the Above Network LLC. Is that disclaimer enough, John, or do you think
I think that'll probably work for at least this revelation, yes.
But you are in for a hell of a ride with John Lear when he talks about the CIA days. And I mean, Johnny and I were like cats, you know, or deer that sees the headlights coming towards him. We're just, you know, in awe, because you give John a topic, and I mean, he takes the ball and runs with it, yeah. To say the least. Yeah.
And so right after this brief message, we'll get right into our chronicle of John Lear's CIA adventures.
Good morning, citizen. Your mission, if you choose to accept it, is to go to www.abovepolitics.com. There you will be able to gather up the necessary intel needed to be successfully informed. You'll not only learn what's happening in the U.S., but also in the U.K., Europe, and the world over. We suggest you familiarize yourself with issues such as the economy, military security actions, energy and science, religion, and spiritual influences. It would also be wise to visit the political ideology area to gather up as much information as you can in these areas. General ideology, conservatism, liberalism, socialism, and the moderate. While there, also be sure to check out what others are saying in the Slugfest arena. The intel you gather from Politics of War and the debate forum will be essential in getting into the right mindset on who is a friend or who is a foe. We'd like you to also keep tabs in the candidates area for information as to whom has their sentiments floating either to the right or to the left, as this could prove to be invaluable. I can't stress enough to act in a civil way while at www.abovepolitics.com as to not raise any suspicions as to your true identity and agenda. Good luck with your quest, citizen. This message will now self-destruct.
The following is an ATS Mix exclusive interview.
I would definitely suggest...
I'm recording now.
Yeah, I would definitely start recording now, because we may get some good material when he answers.
Who knows? Right? That's right.
Who knows? Here we go.
Hello. You have reached the Cutthroat Mining Corporation. We are closed for the weekend, but we just wanted to let you know what a bunch of pricks Dave and Johnny were for giving that airhead John Rhodes more time than me on the last show. It is a fact that Dave and Johnny gave John Rhodes at least 15 more mentions than he did John Lear. Have a nice f***ing day.
Well, I think that's our intro right there. Yeah, that's a keeper. You'll have to do one little minor edit on your F-bomb, but other than that, I think Pricks is FCC compliant. Prick my finger. There you go. Hey, John, what's happening?
Well, if I could get paid for all this f***ing work I do for you guys.
You haven't been getting those checks yet?
No, I had to go up to the mine at... But night before last, Kurt stepped out for, my friend stepped out for a smoke in front of the cabin. He said, John, quick, come here. And I went out, and there's f***ing blue light ascending into the sky. It was the weirdest thing.
Really?
And it just stopped. It just stopped and then went out. F***ing Kurt was beside himself.
Wow.
It wasn't anything normal, that's for sure. And, you know, I've been up there for, 20 years on and off, but 10 years solid, I ain't seen anything. But, you know, that area is famous for weird stuff. Kurt right. grew up there beginning in 1970, and there was all kinds of going on up there with flying saucers and aliens and government triangles and weird stuff and everything. But, you know, like I say, I've been there about 10 years, and I haven't seen anything.
Wow.
I think it was the 23rd. And I was sitting there working on the garage and listening to that f***ing Kenny G. You know, 105.7 is the only channel, the FM station will come up there. And for some reason, all those f***ing idiots play is saxophone, you know, tenor sax, alto sax, soprano sax. I mean, it's unbearable, you know. And, of course, Kenny G comes in with his bull there. And I was thinking, you know, I'll bet you Dave and Johnny set this f***ing thing up.
Well, what is it about Kenny G that you don't like, John?
Well, did you get the quote? I mean, it was such a f***ing masterful quote. I wish I could lay my hands on it. As a matter of fact, during our conversation today, I'll see. Wait, I might have that file right here. Hold on just a second.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, it's obvious that you guys don't listen to what or read anything I say, but...
No, that's Dave that doesn't read. I read.
Oh.
I'm just trying to give our listeners a better idea of why you don't like Dave and I know why you don't like Kenny G, but maybe you could share with our listeners.
It's so vacuous.
Uh-huh.
And as a matter of fact, hold that thought here. It's not in the quit am complaint. It's not in my bills file.
Mm-hmm.
Might be in the stuff to be taken care of. Oh, yeah, here it is. Hold on a second.
Okay.
I'm going to set the phone down. Cause
sure, sure, not a problem. Our listeners love dead air. Maybe we could play a little background music right about now, Dave.
Love the background music, yeah. Yes. Mm.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, we'd like to welcome our newest sponsor for the John Lear CIA interview. Chronicles, Kenny G.
That's lovely.
I love that part, yeah, it's nice. the hell did he go to the bathroom? Where did he say he was going?
He's looking for the Kenny G information for our listeners. Oh. And I think it is appropriate that we're playing a little Kenny G in the background.
Well, folks, here it is.
You okay, never know. You got the recorder on?
Oh, yes. Well, yes, sir.
The recorder's
on. This is the most f***ing beautiful description of Kenny G, and it comes out of an article by Tim O'Shea, which is Why Americans Will Believe Almost Anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't refer specifically to Kenny G, but it does. He says, and I quote, the artistic Mojave of modern music with its soulless cyber droning, a constant quest for the nadir of reptilian brain stimulation, devoid of lyrical competence, instrumental proficiency, or passion. Now, is that Kenny G or what?
You know, I wish he had
to read it again, or did you get it the first time?
No, I think it is Kenny G.
Don't try to talk over me.
Sorry.
What's that f***ing music in the back there?
Well, John, we wanted to tell you that we now have to try to go out and secure our own sponsors for shows. And we put up on the internet that we were looking for a sponsor for the John Lear CIA Chronicles show, and Kenny G decided that he wanted to be your sponsor.
What else is in it?
We're just screwing with you, John. Did you even hear the music the first time, or were you too busy in your Kenny G rant?
I was too busy in my Kenny G rant. What did you play?
Never mind. You can hear it when you listen to your show. Yeah, we were playing it the entire time in the background when you were sitting there ranting.
Oh, and you were playing Kenny G?
Yes.
Yeah.
You son of a bitch. I shouldn't even do this program.
There are some people that seem to think that Kenny G is so bad, that's why they didn't give him a full last name. Kenny G, whiz, turn it off.
No, I saw it somewhere. I actually Googled him trying to get some stuff to just jack with John with. And,
yeah, really?
And,
yeah, the figures.
he just goes by G. Anyway. All right, listen, John, we have a ton of fans worldwide, but this show really is for a group of fans that I have developed over the last 18 months at military.com. And it's nothing but military people that's on the site, on the forums and whatever. It's really a neat site, and I want to take this opportunity to say hello to Rob Rodriguez, who is the forum administrator there, and also Vince Patton, my good friend, also with military.com. But I especially want to thank the moderators and the members that participate in the Army, Marines, Air Force, Coast Guard, and the families area, which is really phenomenal, the families of soldiers and loved ones. I
want
to
hang
really
on there, buddy. What about the Navy?
What about the Navy?
Exactly. What about the Navy? I didn't hear you mention the Navy.
I guess I should say that, okay, I'll be honest. I love the Navy people, but I have a little problem with one of the moderators. But I'm just kidding. A shout out to all our Navy fans, too, because you guys have been phenomenal to me, and I really appreciate it. Now, back to what I was saying, John. We've got all these fans, and there were several articles over the last several months that had to do with Air America. And because you were involved with Continental Air in the CIA scenario, I made a couple of posts, and I said, well, you know, what would you think if I could get an interview with John Lear, who participated in the Continental Air campaign? And people were really just chomping at the bit. So really, this show really is for them, because I want to talk about, on this show, not about Kenny G, not about anything else, but about what you did in the CIA and this particular campaign, John. So, first question, out of the box. How did you, obviously your pilot background and everything else, people can Google John Lear and find out anything they want. But how did the CIA recruit you?
Oddly enough, they didn't recruit me. I recruited myself. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know I was working for the CIA for the first 4 years. Because
really?
I went to work flying for World Aviation in Florida, ferrying Air Force airplanes to Vietnam. And what happened is, you know, in 1966, they were, well, actually before that, 64 is when it really started cranking up. And 65 is when they started producing airplanes. And then when they really got into the war, they found out they were missing one vital airplane, and that was a forward air control airplane. So they went to Cessna, and they decided to use the Cessna 337 push-pull airplane for forward air control and for PSYOPs. And the O2A had the PSYOP speakers in them where they'd go over the and they'd blast Kenny G music to the Vietcong. And then they had the O2B, which had the rockets and all the fancy electronic equipment, all the communications equipment. They had FM, UHF, VHF, and I think they had one other thing. But then those were used for forward air control, and the Air Force, I think, ordered about 360 of them. And as Cessna started cranking them off the assembly line in Wichita, they had to figure out how to get them over there. Well, of course, you can't send them on a boat because, you know, there were no boats available, and it just takes too long. They couldn't, you know, all the Air Force guys were being used for other programs. They didn't have enough Air Force pilots to do this. So the Air Force went to the CIA and said, we need you to set up a program to get those airplanes over there. So the CIA set up a wholly owned subsidiary there in Florida called World Aviation, staffed it with air guys, and started hiring pilots to start ferrying these airplanes over to Republic of Vietnam, and specifically Nha Trang for the first 2 years, and then Benoit for the final 2 years of the contract. About 6 months into the program, I heard about this, and I thought, boy, that sounds neat. And I called Wichita, called up World Aviation Service. It just happened that a friend of mine that used to work at Learjet ran the operation there. He said, sure, John, come on, you know, we can use pilots, you know, when can you get here? And so that's how I got hired. But nobody said anything about the CIA, and I never heard anything about the CIA until I got to Laos and ran into one of the my buddies there, and we got to talking about stuff. And he said, you notice the same guys are around here running this operation with the world? And I said, yeah, I noticed that. So, you know, that's when I got clued in. Now, when I flew those O2s, you know, it was a tremendously exciting program for me because, you know, I was young and I was patriotic and, you know, I was doing this for God and my country, and it was exciting flying. It wasn't that dangerous, but, you know, it wasn't all that safe. But it was my first mix with Air Force guys. Now, I couldn't get into the Air Force because of my physical problems after my crash in 1961, plus the fact I'm medium red, green, colorblind. So I wouldn't have fit in, even if I could have gotten in. But I enjoyed being with military personnel. And I met were great guys. I think there was one guy I had a mix-up with, but it was basically my own fault. But I met some wonderful guys over those four years of that contract. Great guys. I wish I could run into them. One was Major Charlie Brown there at Hamilton Air Force Base, who flew C-130s, and they would duck butt us out a third of the way. And a duck butt is an escort airplane. And what happens is somebody has a problem, they fly around until search and rescue or somebody else. I mean, they are search and rescue. Until somebody else can clear up the problem. But we spent a lot of times in the bars of those guys. I heard a year ago that Charlie Brown was very ill. If he happens to hear this, Charlie, I haven't seen you in 40 years. I wish you'd give me a call because we had some great times together.
If I could just ask here real quick, John, I'm just curious. When you did finally find out that the organization that you were working for was backed by the CIA, how did you feel about that?
Well, I was, you know, at the time I was working for another one that was backed by the CIA, Continental Air Services, Inc. And Continental Air Services, Inc. Was a project formed by Pierre Salinger, who was President Kennedy's press secretary. And, of course, after Kennedy was assassinated, Pierre Salinger, at the end of that term, he left the White House. Johnson didn't pick him up, but because he knew of the Air America thing, he went to the president of Continental Air Services, which was the guy that married Audrey Meadows. I'll remember him in a second.
Steve anyway, Allen? Like,
Jane Meadows.
Oh.
One of the Meadows sisters. And he was president of Continental Airlines. He went to this guy and he said, you know, there's something going on over in Southeast Asia, and there's an airline over there that the CIA runs, but there's no reason why we can't form our own airline and get in on the same contracts. They went to Saigon, and they found a guy named Ed Dearborn, and they bought a company called Bird & Sons, and they put Ed Dearborn in charge of it, called the Continental Air Services, Inc., wholly owned subsidiary of Continental Airlines. And they started getting contracts right and left, just like Air America. And pretty soon they're in Saigon, Udorn, and Vincennes, and, you know, growing faster. And it wasn't like Air America could handle everything anyway. I think Air America had 20 different types of airplanes, and I think Continental ended up with at least 10 or 15. I mean, there was so much money over there floating around for anything and everything, because the job had to get done, and nobody cared how much it cost.
Right. So really, the Continental Air was more of a commercial enterprise than it was a CIA enterprise.
It was a commercial enterprise, yes, and it was operated under the direction and control of the CIA.
Okay, so the CIA did have some control over what you guys did or didn't do, even though it was Continental Airlines / whatever, right?
We didn't move without CIA. I mean, they were running the secret war in Laos. They had all their personnel on the ground, plus they were backing General Vang Pao, who we were supporting, who was fighting the Pathet Lao and the North Vietnamese. The alleged program in Laos was we were trying to obstruct or somehow limit the supplies that were coming down from North Vietnam to South Vietnam, and some of those trails came through Laos. But there was billions of trails. There was no way to stop it. You know, and this was just an exercise in futility. I get there to Laos. I came up from Cambodia. Now, I was in Cambodia for a private company, and the company was called Tri-9 Airlines. We flew a Convair 440. To this day, I don't know whether it was CIA supported. I don't think it was. And I see some of the guys occasionally that worked with me. But we flew a normal passenger airline from Phnom Penh up to Battambang, which was the city the farthest northwest in Cambodia, and then we'd also fly out to Kompen San. Now, there was always a bunch of military guys on the flight, and they may or may not have. It wasn't my interest. I wasn't interested in that. It was always, you know, I just loved the flying. It was great flying because there wasn't one friggin' radio aid, and, you know, we were flying down to minimums on just speed, time, and distance, and it was tremendously challenging. and I found it interesting. Anyway, the co-pilot, Bill Davis, one day says, you know, we're making money up here, but you could make three times as much up in Laos. And I said, yeah, how's that? He said, you go to work for Continental Air Services. And I said, okay, well, is it dangerous? And he said, well, yeah, they shoot at you a lot, but, you know, all the pilots, I said, I don't want to get shot at. And he said, well, it's no problem. All the pilots, you know, when they get their books and manuals, they just sit on those when they go over the dangerous areas.
Right.
And I thought, okay, well, that sounds good to me. So I said, how do I get hired? He said, go see a guy, go down to downtown Phnom Penh in Cambodia, and see a guy named Kurt Fuhrer. He's at Sucindo Shipping and Trading. So I went down and saw Kurt Fuhrer. I said, I'm interested in going to work for Continental Airlines. And he pulled out an application for Continental Airlines. He said, fill this out, bring it back, and I'll send it in. So I filled it out, and a few weeks later, somebody showed up from Los Angeles, Continental Airlines, and interviewed me. And I think the guy's name was Bill Hahn, but I really can't remember. But he said, why do you want to go up there? And I said, well, the money and the flying and stuff. He says, you know, you're going to be flying with a bunch of balls. And I said, no, that's okay. I think I can fit in. And he said, okay, you're hired. He said, when can you get away? And I said, well, anytime. So I pack up my stuff and quit Tri-9 Airlines. And, of course, they were extremely unhappy. But I headed up to Laos. Now, the interesting thing is it turns out that Kurt Fuhrer was head of the Swiss CIA in Southeast Asia. And if you guys remember a spy writer named John le Carré, he wrote a book called The Honorable Schoolboy. And so I've got a copy of The Honorable Schoolboy, and there's a couple of interesting things I'd like to quote out of this. First of all, I have Kurt Fuhrer's business card stapled into the front of it. And then this was all happening in 72. And also in the tucked in the front of this book, The Honorable Schoolboy, I have his death announcement. He was murdered in Bangkok on 25th of October, 1982. And I got this card, and it says, "The management and staff of Sucinto Shipping and Trading regret to announce that our managing director, Mr. Kurt Fuhrer, has passed away suddenly on Monday, 25th October, 1982 in Bangkok." And so I keep this in my book, and in the foreword, John le Carré says, "In Phnom Penh, my genial host, Baron Walter von Marshall, took marvelous care of me, and I could have never managed without the wisdom of Kurt Fuhrer and Madame Yvette Pierpoli of Sucinto Shipping and Trading, and currently in Bangkok." Now, the interesting part is back on page 368, he has one paragraph, and he says, and he's talking about one of the spies had rented one of these airplanes and to go up to Vientiane, and it was full of pigs, and it was dirty, and there was a guy sitting in the back, and he describes, he says, "There was one other member of the party, and he lurked alone on the top of the cases in the tail, head almost against the roof, and it was not possible to make him out in any detail. He sat with a bottle of whiskey to himself and even a glass to himself. He wore a Fidel Castro hat and a full beard. Gold links glittered on his dark arms, known in those days to all those who wore them as CIA bracelets, on the happy assumption that a man ditched in hostile country could buy his way to safety by doling out a link at a time. But his eyes, as they watched Jerry along and well-oiled barrel of an AK-47 automatic rifle, had his fixed brightness." Now, I have my CIA gold bracelet. It weighs a pound. I don't wear it anymore because it cuts off the circulation of my arm. But I'm going to hold it up here to the telephone receiver to show you it.
Oh, yeah, that looks great.
Part. Yeah.
That's nice.
It's very beautiful. Nice. I brought it out for
my birthday on December 4th, my 65th birthday. And I
Happy birthday, John. Happy birthday. Belated.
And the birthday was really great. I had 40 of my closest friends, and Bob Lazar showed up as a surprise guest.
Did he really?
Was he in the cake? It was just great having my old friends here. So anyway, you're asking me to tell you, I wanted to tell you how I got up into Laos. I got up there from Cambodia. So I arrived in Laos and start flying as a co-pilot on a C-46. I never checked out as a captain with Continental Air Service because I have a real piss-poor f***ing attitude, and they can recognize it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And so I rode shotgun, it's what they call flying co-pilot, riding shotgun, for all the time I was there. For the first six weeks up there, you drop rice. Now, there's two kinds of rice.
What the hell's that mean?
Rice. What?
Bags of rice, Dave.
Oh, I thought maybe food. It was a secret word or something. Oh, okay, you really drop rice. Okay, sorry.
Okay, there's two kinds of rice. Regular rice and hard rice.
Hard
rice is guns and ammunition. And if it's just rice, then everybody knows it's real rice. I mean, you're taking it up to the Laotians who are starving, and you have these, maybe 20 or 30 bags in a C-46. They're all loaded up there in pallets. And the pilot flies over the designated drop area.
Right.
And he has a button on his wheel, and that button rings a bell in the back. Now, there's two kickers in the back. They call the guys that push the ride out kickers. And they line up these pallets, and each pallet has maybe 10 or 15 bags of rice on it. And they're poised. They have harnesses, and they have goggles and hats, caps.
Right.
And when they hear, they push that thing out. And what it does is the back door of the C-46, it goes to the door, goes over about 2 feet, and then tips, and the bags fall out. They don't have any parachutes or anything because they're built sturdy, and when they hit the ground, they don't break. Most of the time, they don't break.
Right.
But anyway, that's dropping rice. So you do that for about 6 weeks, and when your clearance comes from Langley, in other words, they've checked you out, you're a good guy, you're not a spy and everything, then you go up to upcountry and drive the hard rice. And, you know, that's the fun stuff. That's where you got shot at. And it was a very challenging experience.
John, let me stop you right here. Speaking of that, all right, you're working for the CIA. Once you get qualified, now you're doing some serious military ops kind of stuff. So, I mean, when you get to that level, John, and you're doing all that stuff, I mean, does the CIA come to you and say, I mean, it's been rumored, you know, that they get, they, you know, they kind of like the Mission Impossible thing, you know, if you get captured, John Lear, you know, we have nothing to do with you, whatever, they give you a black pill. I mean, any of that kind of stuff going on when you...
No black pill, but they make it specific. And every job I did, don't call us. Do not call us. We don't know you. We don't want to know you. And, you know, that's what happened to Hassenfuss. Down there in Nicaragua.
Right.
And everybody else that's been cashed out. I mean, if you get caught doing something that's illegal, you go to jail and you do your 20 years and keep your mouth shut. And nobody's going to come to the, you know, to the jailer and say, hey, look, man, you know, this is one of our guys.
Right, right. They're not going to claim, they're not going to claim you, in other words. They're not going to claim.
Absolutely not. They're going to say they don't have any friggin' idea what you were doing, and they certainly had nothing to do with it.
Okay, now, now my second part of that question is, can you tell me probably, you know, within the realm of what you may be allowed to say after 36 years with the freedom of information?
I can say anything.
Well, okay, good. In that case, tell me about any secret mission that you did and what the purpose of the secret mission. And I'm not talking about dropping rice. I'm talking about taking, you know, military equipment, dropping troops, whatever, you know, behind the lines, trying to go into North Vietnam, whatever. What is the most notable secret mission that you ever flew over there?
Would be the one in Mogadishu in 1978. And what that was Russia traditionally supported Mogadishu, and the United States traditionally supported their lifelong enemy, Ethiopia. As a matter of fact, in Ethiopia, we had our space tracking station, and we were good friends with Haile Selassie. The Russians built a deep water port on the Red Sea called Berbera. And in those days, and still these days, the name of the game is real estate on the Red Sea, because if the Straits of Hormuz are ever closed up there to the north, that means that all oil has got to go out the Red Sea. And
right.
You better have real estate on the Red Sea if you're going to get that oil. So, you know, we wanted, down at the tip of the Red Sea, you have Aden to the north, and you have Mogadishu to the south. So both of those were Russian, and there was no way, I mean, if they wanted to, they could cut off the oil, because if the Straits of Hormuz is closed, particularly as if we attack Iran, there's no doubt that they're going to close the Straits of Hormuz. That oil has to be shipped down to a place in Saudi Arabia called Yanbu. It'll be loaded up on ships then and go out the Red Sea. But you better have real estate on the Red Sea, or you're going to be in a world of hurt. So anyway, in those days, we didn't have the thing. So what happened is the Russians made the mistake of supporting the Ethiopian rebels, and in addition to supporting Mogadishu. So Mogadishu, or Somalia, kicked the Russians out. They said, get out of here. If you're going to support our lifelong enemy, you can just get out. So what we did is we went in, and the United States said, hey, is there anything we can do to help you? And they said, yeah, we need more guns and ammunition to fight our enemies. They said, well, we'd be really happy to help. Now, remember, this was going on in 1978, way before any of this last Somalia stuff came up.
Right.
So anyway, Somalia and Ethiopia get ready to fight the war. Okay, now, one thing you got to have when you fight a war is ammunition, because you've collected all these guns over the years, and you got to have that ammunition. So unfortunately for Somalia, they've got all these East Bloc guns and cannons and everything, these ammunition, and their friend is the United States, who doesn't have any of that stuff, East Bloc ammunition. And Haile Selassie, Ethiopia, is getting ready to fight, and they have all these Western-type guns, but no Western-type ammunition, neither is the Russians. So there was a top high-level trade between Russia and the United States to trade ammunition so they could fight their wars.
Right.
So the ammunition, the East Bloc ammunition, was stored in Hungary and had to be taken to Somalia. And, of course, nobody, you know, in those days, United States Air Force didn't get into this stuff. Now they do it all themselves. They don't have to hire anybody to do it, you know.
Right.
But in those days, they used to try and keep it secret. So my usual contact, Hank Wharton, called me up. He said, John, we got a program going on over here. Can you meet me in Frankfurt? I said, okay, fine. You know, so I went to Frankfurt and checked into the Intercontinental Hotel there at the airport. Let's see, this is 1978. Wow. And I was supposed to get a message that evening, and I thought, well, I'll just go down and see a movie. It just happened to be James Bond. So I go down there, I'm all charged up. Here I am, ready to go on a secret mission. I'm going to get myself, you know, in the mood here by watching a James Bond movie. So I walk into the airport theater, and I sit down, and as I'm sitting there, I notice about six or seven guys in front of me, and they started turning around, and I realized these were all the guys I had just been in Egypt with flying, and I said, what are you guys doing here? And they said, you don't think you're getting on this deal without us, do you? So later we get a telephone call that says, go down to Lufthansa and tell them your name. There'll be tickets there to go to Budapest. And when you get to Budapest, get a taxi and go to the Hilton Hotel. Go into your room and wait for a call. When you get a call, you'll go to another room. So what we do is we all get on the airline. I think there might have been 10 of us. We get on Lufthansa. We land at Budapest, walk into customs there, and there's a couple of Americans, obviously Americans, standing behind the Hungarian customs officials. And they would identify each one of us, and we'd get to go in. You know, we'd get stamped, and that was it. We'd go with them. So, you know, obviously the CIA had everything under control. There was no problem. Everybody knew what was going on, you know. So anyway, we get in the cabs, and we go to the Intercontinental Hotel. So as a matter of fact, I just pulled out a number of documents that I keep in a scrapbook here, and I was just noticing
that doesn't surprise me, John.
Would you like a little music background for this?
I still have the Lufthansa ticket, and it's dated 22 October 1978, Frankfurt, Budapest, and I still have my key to the Budapest Hilton, and so then we get to the Budapest Hilton, and go up to her rooms, and then there's a call, and it says, go to, you know, room whatever. And so we all go to room one ever. So there's a bunch of chairs around this room, and everybody sits in this chair, and this guy comes in. It's Hank Wharton. He was the premier CIA gunrunner for years. He was in Biafra. He did all kinds of things. He was an interesting guy. I knew him for 20 years. I worked for him for, you know, 5 or 6 years. He was polite. He was generous. I would have done anything for Hank, and he showed me a lot of things. You know, I'm not an entrepreneur myself. I'm just a pilot, but, you know, I just amazed at this guy, how cool and calm he was. Once he had a briefcase, just a small briefcase, and it had $1 million in cash, and we just walked right through customs. You know, it was just amazing how this guy operated. But anyway, he comes in the room, and he says, he puts the finger to his mouth like, shh, you know, I don't want anybody to talk here. So he has this captain's brief, and I have the original captain's brief with me, and I'm going to read it to you. But what he did, what he would take this little piece of paper, and he'd point to a guy, and it meant read that while I'm talking. And then he said, hey, I want to welcome all you guys to Budapest. You know, it's fall. It's a beautiful time of the year. You're going to enjoy your stay here. I'll give you a little history on Budapest. Budapest sits on the north. Pest sits on the south of the Danube. And he goes into the history of all this. And each time a guy finishes the reading of this piece of paper, he takes the next guy and points to him. You know, and that guy is supposed to read. And then he goes on with this blah, blah, blah. You know, and the history of Buddha goes back, you know, hundreds of years. And it just continues on with this dialogue as each guy is reading. So here's the, I'll just read a few things of the captain's brief. And it says, one, whilst in Buddha, assume your conversation is overheard at all times. Two, never refer to your destination except by calling it Lagos or just destination. Three, you will meet a Mr. Gunta in Buddha. He is from the Ministry of Defense. He will try to make himself helpful. Accept his help only when needed. He will give you the impression he works for or with us. He does not. Only talk to him in general terms, except when you're reloading and scheduling, where you will cooperate with him in full. Four, you fly in and out of Buda as Fretflug Icelandic Airlines. Crossing border into Yugoslavia, you are Air Trans of Miami on lease to Fretflug. From Yugoslavia to the Greek border, you are Air Trans of Miami. On contact with Jeddah, you are Somali Airlines through Jeddah and onwards, and the same on return. However, always use your registration as call sign, except you will be given a Somali Airlines flight number through Jeddah onwards. Five, overflying Egypt has been paid for in advance, and an Air Trans agent in Zakari Air Service who guarantees rights and charges. Six, at Jeddah, you are handled by Saudi Tours. Fuel is prepaid. 7. At destination, you will be met by Mr. Waldemeyer. He will assist you in every way, except give you no credit. Mr. Fabry Hotel will also be there. 8. At any place you run into reporters, do not talk to anybody. 9. Officially, you are flying agricultural machinery and chemicals from Budapest to Jeddah. All overflights and transit requests state that. Then at the bottom, then after that, it says, remember, in great big letters, it says, remember, walls listen. Number 10, do not change any money in Buda except officially, never on the black market. 11, always pay cash for your food, drink, and services. And that was the end of the captain's brief. And so after each guy had read this, he says, okay, now we're going to go for a nice dinner and a little walk around Budapest. And he's always, you know, he's got his finger up to his lips, like, don't say anything.
Right.
So we walk out there, and I can't remember the exact directions from the Hilton Hotel to the famous chain bridge that crosses the Danube. But we all walked out on this bridge, and then he gave us the real briefing. And then he said, look, we're taking arms and ammunition to Somalia. And you'll never, to Mogadishu, you'll never say that name to anybody. He said, just assume that all walls listen. Don't discuss it among yourselves. Don't make any telephone calls, you know, anything. He said, we should have a number of flights. He said, I don't know how many, but but it should be a contract and lucrative for all of you. So let's go have dinner. And so then we walked off the bridge and I think the flight was the next day. We went to the Hilton. I'll always remember that dinner because the Budapest Hilton was so elegant and so, you know, the service was perfect. The food was fantastic, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, this is really great. I can almost do this for a living. The next day was absolutely total 00 at Budapest Airport, and there was 4 707s lined up on the ramp, and there was a bunch of military guys around. I was, you know, kind of appointed the chief pilot because, you know, I had been with Hank. I'd done things for him before. And so I chose the crews, got everybody lined up. I got in the very first 707, the one that was in front. And, you know, you couldn't see your hand before you. We got in. We checked the weight. There was no way to check the load. They were boxes. I didn't care what was back there. You know, all I wanted is, you know, to fly and the enjoyment of flying and do the job professionally. And you know, there were some jokes. I mean, there between the crew, we go back in the front. You could see it labeled as certain types of ammo. I forget what it was. So anyway, we start up the engines and pull out. Now, you know, in the United States, you have to have minimum of a quarter of a mile to take off. In some cases, a half a mile. But this is not the United States, and this is a secret mission, and nobody gives a shit. So I just pulled out, asked the tower for takeoff. And so I go roaring down the runway. Later, I find out that Hank, you know, doesn't realize that we're just going to go for it. And he thinks we're going to be delayed, which is going to screw up the plans, you know, down the line. But he said, I was really happy, John. He says, when I called and said, you know, when do you think they'll be able to take off? They said, oh, they left 6 hours ago. He said, I was just leaping for joy. So we head down through Europe and down through Greece and over the Mediterranean and get into land at Jeddah. And we get at Jeddah and fuel. And, you know, we were loaded absolutely to the gills. And so we couldn't take that much fuel because, you know, you have to be careful. First of all, you know, it's always Jetta, so even in October, so you're limited somewhat. So I didn't take as much fuel as I would have liked to take, because down in Somalia, there's never any weather. I mean, it's always clear down there. So anyway, we leave Jetta, and now when we take off to Jetta, it's total radio silence, because this part of the flight is not supposed to be taking place.
Right.
So when the tower clears you for takeoff, they said, cleared for takeoff. And that's the last thing you hear. They're not going to say contact ATC, you know, nothing. You're on your own, buddy. They don't want to hear from you.
And there's no communication between the pilots themselves during this time either, right?
No. No, we didn't do any of that stuff.
Okay.
But, you know, all my other flights I did it, you know, get on 12345 and bull all the way across the Pacific. But so we get into the air. Now, it turns out later we find out why we are the chosen pilots. It turns out this operation has been going for at least 2 months doing these flights. But what happened is a couple of days before all of us were called, they had, you know, another crew flying it. And as you take off and head down the Red Sea from Jeddah to Mogadishu, the airplane is painted almost like a Somali Airlines. It has a yellow tail,
right,
but it doesn't have the insignia. So, you know, the ruse here is if Aiden, client of Russia, sends up a MiG-21 or something to shoot you down, because, see, they know what's going on. They just don't want you to get there, and they're pissed. So what they want to do is catch you. Well, you know, the problem is they don't have the time or money to spend 24 hours a day up there, and they don't know when you're coming down, you know, towards the Red Sea.
Right.
So what happened is a few days before we got called is that one of the airplanes, one of Somali Airlines, got forced down into Aden thinking it was us.
Mm.
And everybody knows that if they'd have gotten one of the arms airplanes, they would have been, you know, shot on the spot.
Sure.
And so all those pilots chickened out, left en masse, and left Hank there, you know, scraping the bottom of the barrel, and there I was, you know. But we didn't know this at that time, see.
Right.
So anyway, here we go, and we're headed down the Red Sea in radio silence, and we're discussing what we're going to do. And, I mean, if we get intercepted. And, you know, I'm kind of a fatalist. I said, you know, we're not going to outmaneuver any kind of fighter airplane.
Right.
And, well, you know, maybe we could make a try for it. And I said, look, you know, if we get it, you know, we're...
Yeah, against the MiG, there's, right.
There's nothing going to be any fancy. We're not going to dogfight him. You know, we're going to land and get shot, you know, like a man. It reminds me of that story in Vietnam where one of these forward air control pilots are up there, and his airplanes have been shot up, and he's on the mic and he's screaming, holy shit, I've been shot, I can't do anything, my leg's shot, you know, and help me, and what do I do? And a real calm voice comes on the mic and says, just shut up and die like a man.
I had heard a story about that. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, so here we go down, and we finally get to, you know, a little worried. We get by Aden, and we get over Somalia, and we head down to Somalia. We call up Somalia for the weather, and it's f***ing 0-0 in a rainstorm. You know, and here I am, short of gas, because I, you know, in my infinite wisdom, had decided there was going to be no weather in Mogadishu. And, you know, in those days, they didn't have anything like an ILS, you know, mm-hmm. to shoot and approach with. All they had was a beacon, an ND, what they call a non-directional beacon. And, you know, and we're up a creek down there. So, you know, if I do say so myself, you know, there's one or two times where God has blessed me with the ability to do something that was really needed. Not that I had that natural ability. And I did an NDB approach to weather 100 1/4, and, you know, came right out on it, and people talked about, the crew talked about that for years, you know, because it was really a feat of airmanship, if I don't mind saying myself. But we won't mention any more of that. So we land, pull over, and there's some American soldiers, and they unloaded us, and we go into town. I think we were going to, it was going to take them like 3 or 4 hours, and we went to a little scrubby apartment and, you know, just lie down for a little while. And then somebody comes out to the airplane's ready to go back. And so then we go through the whole thing again, fly to Jeddah, fly to Buddhist, you know, have one night out, and then go back. So anyway, that was one of the most secret missions I ever did. The other one, the other secret mission, never actually went. And that was in October, to give you a little history, in October, I think it was 22nd of 1979, when Bush and Reagan, or Reagan and Bush, were running against Carter and Mondale, you know, the hostages had already been held up in Tehran for a year. And the big election point was, you know, how do we get the hostages out? What can we do? And Carter was doing everything he could get the hostages out. And because Bush had been director of CIA, he knew a lot of inside stuff that those guys didn't. So what he did is he got on a BAC-111, which is a business jet, at Andrews Air Force Base on Saturday, October 19th, at night at Andrews. And they flew in his BAC-111 to Paris. And what he did is he met with Rafsanjani, who was second in command to the Ayatollah Khomeini, and he said, if you'll delay the release of the hostages until the Reagan nomination, if he wins, we'll supply you with unlimited guns and ammunition throughout the duration of our administration. This became known as the October Surprise. There were two books written about it, one by Barbara Honecker and one by Gary Sick, which detailed all the stuff that I'm telling you, so that nobody missed Bush, that no time was unaccounted for. When he was done with the meeting, he was driven to Reims Air Force Base, and there was an SR-71 there that flew him direct to McGuire Air Force Base in the United States, and he made a tennis appointment that morning, which would have been the Sunday morning, and nobody missed a beat. None of the reporters missed it, everything. And eventually, there was congressional hearings for that, but most everybody was either shot or killed in some manner that had anything to do with this. I'm probably the only guy, one of the few that are left that really knew what happened.
Right.
But anyway, to go back just a little bit further, the Camp David Accords between Israel and Egypt were signed on September 17, 1978, and then that was negotiated by Carter, and then the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty was signed March 26, 1979. And one of the provisos of that treaty was that each country, Egypt and Israel, would provide daily flights 4 times a week into the other country. Well, you know, Israel didn't mind flying into Egypt, you know, but you could not find an Egyptian that would fly into Israel. So what the CIA did is they formed their own airline, pretended it was an Egyptian airline. It was called Air Sinai. I was chief pilot, and I was the guy, I was the pilot that flew those flights 4 times a week into Tel Aviv. And pretended I was Egyptian. We really didn't pretend we were Egyptian. It was just, you know, it was a scam. It was a front. And so I had this white 707. Initially it had no markings, and then later it was, as everybody got used to it, it was labeled Air Sinai, and I ran those flights there. And now in 1981, of course, Reagan and Bush get ready to pay off the Khomeini, because he had been elected, and of course the reason he was elected is Carter couldn't get the hostages out, and his platform was, look, if you are like me, I'll get them out. So he did, but of course nobody knew about, you know, what he had promised them. So rolls along, you know, a year after the election, those arms and ammunition got to be delivered, and in charge of the whole operation was the Mossad, and everything was being shipped to Israel, and it was going to go from Israel up to Turkey and then over to Tehran, because you couldn't fly direct, you couldn't fly over Syria. And Turkey has always been Israel's ally. So the deal was that for every flight that went to Tehran, one flight would drop off the same load to Turkey. That was the bribe. That was the, you know, the quid pro quo for the thing. So
right.
We get ready to make the first flights, and the Mossad, just to be sure everything's okay, sends in an Argentinian CL-44. Now, the Argentinian CL-44 is a giant 4-engine turboprop that Flying Tiger Lions used to use, and it can carry a huge load. So they load up in Tel Aviv and head up to Turkey, and if you can't visualize this, you go generally north to Turkey, get about halfway through Turkey, and then you turn right 90 degrees and head down that corridor between Russia and Syria. There's about 100 miles. It's no problem. You're neither close to either country, and you know, just, you know, it's a no-sweat flight. They get to Tehran, they unload their stuff, and they start headed out. The next thing anybody hears is that Co-44 was shot down over Russia, actually 40 miles south of Yerevan, and everybody was killed. So, you know, what happened? Who, you know, the pilots were briefed, you know, there was no problem with the navigation, so what happened? And the Russians, you know, Russia's story was, hey, they overflew our territory, so the investigation by Mossad eventually determined that what probably must have happened is that they were flying, you know, minding their own business on the way out, and when they got to this little pinch point, which is 100 miles, they got intercepted by MiGs and, you know, motioned to fly up to Yerevan in southern Russia. The crew probably thought, you know, well, what's the problem? We haven't got anything on board. They can't prove anything, so, hey, we'll do it. So as soon as they got over Russian territory, of course, the MiGs shoot them down, and that was the end of that. Of course, that put an end to my 707 flights to do that runs, because Mossad didn't want to have, you know, risk American planes getting shot down on the same thing, but then, because then there would be hell to pay. So it turns out that I never flew that flight, which I was scheduled, and they eventually, CIA gave it to another airline, and they flew out of, I believe, Dubai, and they, or might have been Doha, and they flew direct over the Persian Gulf into Tehran. I never knew any guys of that other operation, but that's, that was, you know, the beginning of Iran-Contra, and that was in 1981. The Iran-Contra investigations only went back as 1985. They never went back or proved any of what I'm telling you, because, you know, most of the guys were killed that were involved in that operation.
Did you have any really harrowing experiences while you were doing some of your flights that involved any enemy fire that you thought, oh boy, this is it, I'm not going to make it on this one?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me tell you the harrowing experience that the first harrowing experience I had. I had just gotten my clearance in Laos from Washington, and that meant I got to go up and fly with the big boys, and I was co-pilot on Twin Otter, and we'd go up into the real scary places, and you know, basically what we were doing is we were carrying ammunition, and they'd load up the back of the Twin Otter that had cargo doors, same thing like the C-46, but, you know, much smaller. And you'd roll in front of the, I forget what they call it, the loading ramp, and they'd have all these bundles of ammunition all in these rows. It was all neatly done. They were all ready for you. You'd roll in there. The guy would come up and hand you a piece of paper, hand the captain a piece of paper, and it would tell you the coordinates that they wanted these drops. They would give you the frequency of the agency guy on the ground to contact before you dropped it.
Right.
And sometimes we wouldn't have a frequency. They'd just say, look, drop it at this point. And then you'd load all this stuff up. There'd be one kicker in the back. So there'd be the pilot, the co-pilot, which was me, and then the kicker in the back. You'd take off, and you'd fly to this point. And when you'd see the panel, there was usually, you know, an orange panel or something to mark it, or there was a guy on the ground that would say, yeah, drop at the, you know, the tree or something like that. And so you'd fly over this place and drop the stuff, and I think there were 8 loads. So each pass, they'd throw one load out, so you had to do it 8 times. So I remember coming into this one place. I remember it was a double or triple red Indias. It was the name, triple red India, yeah. And that made it sound scary anyway, but the drop point was way out on this kind of ridge. And so as we're working our way out, you know, it's really scary because the enemy is all around, you know, and they're always taking, you know, you're always taking some kind of ground fire. And what the co-pilot does is there's a window on the side of the Twin Otter that just pulls down. You just slide it down. And the reason you slide it down is because it makes it easier to hear the ground fire. And so you can tell the captain, you know, he's concentrating on the drop, and he's listening to the other guy with his earphones on, so he's not always aware. And, you know, you can't hear, you know, when you got all your stuff on, you can't hear the small arm stuff. So it was my job to tell him, hey, we're taking incoming. So we're whining, we're just whining our way out there, and it's, you know, real quiet, and it's real spooky, and everything, and just as I rolled back, you don't roll it down, you slide it, at the instant I slid that window down, some helicopter, and, you know, we're all guarding the same frequency, some helicopter pilot, maybe miles away, was doing a sling load, and he was talking to somebody on the ground, and he pressed his mic button, his microphone took a recorded or a broadcast the rup-up-up of the helicopter. So just as I rolled that thing down, I hear, you know, which was the helicopter blades.
Right.
And it scared me so fast, you know, I jumped and hit my head on the panel above the co-pilot, and as Dick Weaver was flying, he looked over at me and saw what had happened, and he couldn't stop laughing. I mean, he couldn't fly. He was laughing so hard. And so anyway, we had to go back and do that job again. But so anyway, the first flight, and I had already been flying up country a few times, but my first time up country after getting my CIA clearance, I'm all jazzed up here. Here I am flying for the CIA. Each, you know, you're assigned a place up country where you're
right.
based. And this one was called Lima 1-6, called Sayaberry. And, Bang Ding. And so we go up there, and a day is usually 14 hours.
Wow.
14 hours of flying. So when you get back, you're pretty beat. So we landed after all this time, and the captain's name was Dave Kuba. He lives in Las Vegas now, and I still see him. We have lunch every week, and we cut talk about the old days. And the Jeep picks us up and takes us to our quarters. I've never been up country, so, you know, I don't know what to expect. Turns out I was assigned this one little four-man tent, and there was like four cots there. So the captain has his own separate tent, and there was nobody else in my tent. So, you know, I dropped my bags and did whatever I need to do, and then there's a little bar 30 to 40 feet away from my tent, and it was just, you know, just a little teeny thing. It could have been, you know, 20 by 10 feet, and I meet Davey, and we walk into this thing, and of course, all the guys, you know, say, hey, John, great to see you, you know, and they're acknowledging, you know, that you got your clearance, and now you're one of the guys, and,
right.
and you have a drink, and, you know, everything's cool.
Sure.
And so during that, you know, you don't drink that much because, I mean, 14-hour flight days, you can't sit there and get plastered and then, you know, get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and fly
right.
14 hours. Although I tried that many times, it still didn't work.
So,
so during the course of the, you know, one or two drinks I had, or let's say two or three drinks I had, well, yeah, you know, four or five drinks I had, somebody mentioned that there might going to be an attack that night. And it was just something that crossed my mind. I didn't, you know, big deal. You know, so anyway, we go to bed because we got to get up early in the morning. And I get on my cot, you know, I strip down totally naked, which I sleep, and the way I sleep. And
well, that's a hell of a thing to be telling our audience, and you sleep nude. Do you still sleep nude today?
Yeah, why? Well, sometimes I wear a T-shirt if it's cold.
Well, that's a scary thought, John. Well,
so I'm on this cot.
You want to know why? Because we socialized with you.
What do you wear? Do you wear pajamas?
No, I wear my Nautica underwear if I ever put them on right. And
no, it's too restrictive.
And a shirt.
Underwear is too restrictive. For one thing, I got a huge set, man, and I'll tell you, they just.
I knew I
could bundle up. You can't bundle those things up for the night.
I'm going to burn in hell for leading us down this path. I'm sorry, members. Go ahead, John.
Okay, so anyway, I lie down and I'm thinking, you know, is this great or what? Here I am flying for the CIA, a hero in my own mind, a legend in my own mind. And,
which
and
we agree.
All of a sudden I hear, kablowie, and holy smokes, I had never heard anything so loud. And the shock waves made the tent go. And I'm thinking, holy smokes, what's going on? And just 1 second later, kablowie, you know? I mean, holy smokes. And the tent goes, I think, holy. And the first thing I said is, you know, when I walked from the bar to the tent to go to sleep, I was going to look and see where the bunker was, but I forgot. And so as the second one went off, I thought, holy shit, how am I going to find that friggin' bunker? And about that time, the third one goes off. Kablowie, you know, and the tent's going. Ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. So I had no choice. All I did was I got on my stomach on the cot and pulled it over on me on the ground. So I'm laying on my back on the ground. Of course, it's a dirt floor. And I've got this cot over me, and the fourth one goes off, kablowie, you know, and I'm trying to hold the cot, you know, as close as I can, you know, to avoid any shrapnel. And so 10 of these things went off, and I'm telling you, by the time it got to the 10th one, wow. I was, you know, by the time we got to the second one, I was thinking, what is this bullshit you're doing over here? You could get killed. Who cares about flying with the CIA? Who cares about God? Who cares about the country? I want to live. So it quiets down, and as the obviously there wasn't going to be another one, I heard ka-dunk, ka-dunk, ka-dunk. And I went, what in the f*** is that? So I tipped the cot back up, right side up, and I dust myself off because I've been lying in the dust there. And I go over, and I pick up the flap of the tent, and my view looked onto the back of this bar. And on the back of the bar that we were in was a target. And these agency guys out there, these CIA guys, they got knives, and they're throwing it at the target. And that's what's making the ka-thunk. And I'm thinking, what in the hell is going on? We just underwent a friggin' attack, and those guys are out throwing knives at a target? What manner of men am I among? I finally get to sleep, and fortunately I had a couple of shooters left there in my bottle, and drifted off to sleep. And so we wake up in the morning, and you know, I get dressed, put my clothes on, get my, you know, my flight bag and my cap and everything ready, and I walk outside, and just as I'm I'm going to head to the mess hall, or there wasn't a mess hall, it was just a table, right. And the captain is coming down, Dave Kuba. We're walking along, and he says, holy smoke, did you hear that last night? He said, that was so loud, it almost sounded like incoming.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I didn't hear anything. You didn't hear anything? I didn't realize that that the agency guys had parked a 4.2 mortar outside my tent, and they lobbed about 10 of these things off. And of course, nobody told me, and of course, I never heard outgoing, you know, that close to me. So
right.
I was hiding from the outgoing. I thought it was incoming. So
well, they did that in Vietnam. You know, there's a lot of people that did that in Vietnam also, weren't really sure whether it was coming or going, you know. So
right. And so I never confessed to this. Well, I did, actually did. I got drunk about 6 weeks later at one of the agency guys at his going away party. And I talked to him later about this, and I said, you know, I've never told anybody this. And he looks at me, and he said, I couldn't figure out what in the hell you were going to tell me. But anyway, I finally confessed to hiding under my cot from the outgoing. But anyway, a couple of months after that, same captain, I, Davey Kuba, and I are flying out of Lima 6-9, and that was a southern base in Laos. We were making a drop just a little ways north of there. I knew, you know, the guy on the ground, he said, you make sharp left turn after drop. And so I looked over at Davey, and I thought he heard it, you know. But when we made the drop, he didn't make a sharp left turn. He made a nice, easy left turn. And the first thing I heard is a kicker in the back. They used to call us cop. He says, cop, 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 cop. And I looked back, and here was he was yelling, and the whole back of the airplane, you know, and we'd only made one drop, so there's like 7 pallets left back there. The whole back of the airplane was it was fog, and it took me a couple seconds to realize it was atomized fuel. And then immediately I realized, we've gotten hit somewhere, and fuel's somehow getting into the back. So then as I realized, about that time the right engine quit. And, you know, I'm on the right side because I'm flying as co-pilot. And I looked out, and they had shot this strut of the Twin Otter. and the fuel was gushing out. Well, because of the air, the way the air forms around the Twin Otter, and because of those great big cargo doors are always open, it was going around in back of the tail and being sucked into the cabin where we had all this fuel. So, you know, Davey realizes what's going on, so he heads back to towards Lima 6-9. So now my dilemma is, it's going to take us 20 minutes to get back there. You know, nobody knows what's going on. Now, you know, as you're flying in any of the theater there, there's two guys circling in 130s. One is Moonbeam and one is Cricket. Cricket flies during the day, and they handle all emergency communications, and they record everything. They know what's going on, you know, and you can call them for anything. If you're flying at night, it's Moonbeam. Well, anyway, Cricket is there, and, you know, I always remember, you know, as flying along, as long as I live, all their announcements you'd hear, this is Cricket on guard with an airstrike warning to all aircraft. Avoid the area, Tango Golf, 612-412 between the periods of 0800 and 0200. This is Cricket on guard out. But anyway, so my dilemma here is this cabin is full of fuel, and nobody knows we're heading back to 69, so there would be no rescue for us if right. we went down. Do I call Cricket? Now, the question here is, when I press that mic button, there's going to be a very minute little bit of electricity, and would that set off this atomized fuel?
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the question in my mind was, do I press that mic button and chance it, you know, to tell Cricket what happened to us and where we are, and or do I just keep my mouth shut and not risk the chance of getting blown up? Well, I decided to press it, and I said, Cricket, this is Poptow Hill Golf. We've taken a hit. We're trying to make it back to 69. We've got the right engine out. And so he says, Roger that. So anyway, the end of the story is we made it. Everything was fine. Continental set up some mechanics of the airplane and repaired us. We got out the next day, but it makes a good war story.
Well, you know, with all these fantastic adventures that you've had, I'm sure you probably have at least one or two equally fantastic scenarios when you were on R&R. Did you have any experiences where you got into a little bit of trouble, John?
Yes. I.
Why does that not surprise me?
On our way, when we'd deliver the forward air control airplanes to Nha Trang, we'd hitch a ride down to Saigon. And when we got down to Saigon, we'd spend 3 days under house arrest because we were not authorized military, although we had military orders, but and we had rank, but we were civilians. And what we did is, Nha Trang is not an authorized port of entry for Saigon, so we were in violation of Vietnam immigration laws. So right. that when we tried to get out, since we didn't have an in stamp, we had to get an out stamp, and right. to get the out stamp, we had to pay a fine and spend 3 days under house arrest. So you had to find things to do for that 3 days of house arrest, and I easily found those things. But when we, on the last day, I think it was the last flight I made was in 1970. And as you remember, or as I may have told you, my first wife was from France. I grew up in Geneva and brought a girl over, beautiful little French girl. Married her, had a couple of kids, married her in 1963, and all this is going on in 66 and 67. Well, in 66, while I was working for a charter company in L.A., I was also, they used my Learjet, or the Learjet of the people I worked for a Batman series, and when Batman was big in those days, the television series. So I was on the set for, you know, a couple of days, and got friends with Adam West, invited my wife down. Well, it turns out that those two hooked up immediately, and to make a long story short, she canned me and dumped me and married Batman.
You're kidding me!
Kidding me!
Yeah, they
Adam West. Her. Adam West nailed your first wife.
Yeah, married her. They're still married. They live up in.
Are you kidding me?
And not only that, my daughter Moya and Jill just spent up there. You know, and I talked to Marcel, you know, for Christmas and
right.
and everything, and they just spent, you know, Moya just came back yesterday from being up there. So anyway, they got married in 1970, probably a couple of months before this story I'm telling you. I go through Hong Kong, unbeknownst to me, I sat on a toilet seat and managed to get the crap. And I think that's how I got it. I'm pretty sure that's how I got it.
Yeah, toilet seat, right.
Anyway, I take a flight back to Pacific Dallas or to Los Angeles on my way to Wichita to pick up another airplane. Well, when I was at home, Marcel called and said, Adam's out of town. Do you want to come on over? And I said, great. So I went over to Malibu where they lived. You know, and spent the night with her, and so it turns out that I gave her the clap, which she gave to Adam, and so I gave...
You gave Batman the clap?
Yeah, by proxy.
What? I gave Batman the clap. What is this world coming to, John? Golly, you gave Batman the clap?
Yeah, by proxy, and not only that, they separated for a year after that, but then he forgave her, because, of course, my kids, when he got home, said, guess who spent the night last night? Our daddy. And that wasn't like bad enough, but, you know, two weeks later, he gets a clap, so he was naturally in the office.
That's the funniest damn thing I've ever heard.
We start out with a CIA John Lear Chronicles, and now Batman's got the clap. What kind of world is this we live in?
Who knew?
Oh, what a funny story, John. But, you know, now here's the thing. I wonder if Robin has the clap. Because you know there was rumors, you know, that Robin was a little light in his loafers, you know?
I don't think so. Adam was light in his loafers. But, and I don't know whether Marcel put a stop to that. I doubt if she did, but probably somebody else got the clap.
So that's why he had purple leotards.
To distinguish. We're all going to burn in hell. You know that, John.
Channel 32, that, you know, the one where A&E, where they do the life of a particular actor.
Right.
Yeah.
You know that?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, they did one on him. It's not that he hates my guts. It's just not that I'm his favorite person in the world. But because, you know, they try to do at least a reasonably honest thing, they had to mention me. And they mentioned me as a member of the Lear family. Marcel was a member of the, you know, married to a member of the Lear family for 5 years, you know. So that's how they got around that. But it's hilarious. I want to put that little segment. It's only like about 20 or 30 seconds long there. But, and I'm told this because I never visited his website, but I'm told that he doesn't acknowledge knowing Marcel until 1971. And, of course, this happened in 1970, and that's
right.
The year they were married. But I guess he doesn't want to mention that John Lear gave him the crap the class of proxy.
Well, I have one question for listening to that story, John. Do you remember the name of the toilet seat? Sorry. All right. Well, listen. I want to end this with something on a more serious note, and that is.
Okay, I've only got half my stories, and you're going to end it.
What, you gave Batman the clap? My God. How can we top Batman getting the clap from you?
We can't.
That's it. You know, I mean, anything you would tell would be anticlimactic to Batman getting the clap from John Lear. Sorry. All right. So no story you could possibly tell would top that one, trust me. I want to kind of end in a kind of semi-climatic way of the CIA Chronicles of John Lear, and that is several, I guess it was back when we were in San Jose, you had told Johnny and I that you guys, and I mean you guys being all the pilots that participated in the Continental Air campaign, were finally recognized after 40-something years for not only your heroism in doing what you did to, you know, try to get everything right according to what the plan was at the time. Tell us about that, John.
Okay, first of all, you want me to read this thing?
If you want to, sure. I mean, I want this to be something, because you were not recognized for years and years and years, and it was a long-going process, and finally Congress finally recognized you guys, and I think that's important, not only for you, John Lear, who's a good friend of us, but for the people that have not survived to this day, to kind of honor their memory. So, yeah, just however you want to end it, John.
Well, I'm happy to read it, but I want to be sure that you play the Star-Spangled Banner while I'm reading it.
I'll find it and I'll put it in post-production.
Okay, he'll edit it,
but you got to put the Star-Spangled Banner. And I don't want to hear Kenny f***ing G playing.
All right.
Okay, the speech of Honorable Loretta Sanchez of California in the House of Representatives, Thursday, October 2nd, 2007. Mrs. Loretta Sanchez of California. Madam Speaker, I rise today to recognize a group of Americans who should have been honored years ago for their service and sacrifice to the United States during the Vietnam War. For a period of 10 dangerous years between 1965 and 1975, over 260 pilots and ground crew members flew over the regions of Southeast Asia. They were Continental Air Services, Inc., CASI personnel. CASI was a subsidiary of Continental Airlines created at the request of the CIA to back up their air service in Southeast Asia for another CIA airline, Air America. CASI personnel flew support missions for the United States Agency for International Development, U.S. Operations Mission, the CIA, and other government agencies. The countries CASI covered included Laos, Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, and Singapore. CASI pilots deserve to be recognized by our government. These pilots played a vital role during the Vietnam War, delivering hard rice, food, medicine, and other supplies. Moreover, CASI pilots were sent on many secret missions to rescue American troops. Madam Speaker, I would like to point out that these were not easy missions. CASI pilots flew for 10 years in the most unfavorable conditions. There were limited air traffic controllers in most regions. The unpredictable weather made flying dangerous. Their planes were constantly under enemy fire. As most of their flights were covert operations, the pilots couldn't even talk about their experiences with their own families. CASI pilots flew the same missions, shared the same airstrips, and sacrificed their lives in America's war effort, as did Air America pilots. In fact, CASI and Air America operated side-by-side for USA during the war. On June 2nd, 2001, the CIA honored Air America and Civil Air Transport for their part in the war effort. However, the CASI pilots and crew did not receive the same recognition. Many CASI pilots have passed away, and some air crews are still missing in action in Laos. After 32 years, the time has come to honor these individuals who sacrificed their own safety for the safety of our American soldiers and for our country. Madam Speaker, please join me in honoring the gallant pilots and crew members of Continental Air Service, Inc. My country 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, for thee I sing.
Land.
Is that okay?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Well, you know, John, you know, I got to tell you, you know, we've been friends several months now. I wanted to do this, as I said at the very beginning of this thing, even though the Batman clap story was worth, you know, that's a show. We could have done a show on that alone. But, you know, I wanted to do this for our military.com friends, those that really had a huge interest in military history. And to me, John, this was really a very historical part that I felt like I wanted to get your story out and those of your fellow Continental pilots, because there was so much emphasis, movies made about it, whatever, about Air America. And once I found out about your personal participation in the Continental part, you know, Johnny and I talked, and we said, you know, we've got to do this. And so I know sometimes when you delve back into some of these stories, although there's some of them that are lighthearted, like the Batman Clap story, but there's also some to where I know you have told me and Johnny personally, you know, to where you have lost friends, people that you that stood beside each other, that were in Bangkok, physically putting their lives on the line, going through the Red China Sea and trying to, you know, evade all the bad guys. So for whatever it's worth, you know, I've never been prouder of any person ever that I could call my friend, because you to me are just epitomize the true energetic spirit that so many people wish they had, but just never can step it up that next notch. And you've really done that with everything you've done in your life, and I really value your friendship.
Thank you, Dave. I value yours.
You know, when I think of American heroes, I envision John Wayne over here to the left, but right over here on the right, there's John Lear. Amazing. They're both named John.
Yeah, in fact, Johnny and I have said before that three of our best acquaintances so far are all named John. John Lear, John Rhodes, and John...
That area.
Yeah, I know. You know, that the reptilian guy, you know. But anyway, you know, I can't thank you enough, John, for the generosity of telling us about the CIA Chronicles of John Lear, because I think it's an important story. I wanted people to know not only about your involvement, but I also wanted them to know about the brave men that served with you in Continental Air, and the fact that they finally got their just recognition by Congress, I think really says it all. I'd like to end the show by...
Well, you know what I'd like, Dave, if you don't mind if I interject this, because sure, I think I know where you're going to go with this. But
okay, fine.
If you would, John, so that we kind of leave this on a more bit of a area here. if you could, sir, possibly you could tell our members, in case they missed it in any of the earlier episodes, tell us how it is that Kenny G goes through the process of making that most wonderful music that he does.
Well, Kenny G, what he does is when he wakes up in the morning, he goes, gets a can of beer, and turns on his drum machine and his recorder, drinks the can of beer, and then goes back to bed with the saxophone in his mouth.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the recording is on, the drum machine is on, and he'll sleep for another, like, 2.5-3 hours, and it records the air going through the saxophone. So then when he wakes up, what he does is he turns off the recorder, and then he divides that 2.5-3 hours up into 6-minute sessions, and he picks out the best of all that, puts it on both sides of a tape, and then releases that as an album.
That is astonishing.
Well, other than me hitting the wrong damn button, I was trying to cut it up and hit the stop button, which, so blame it on me. It's not post-production on Johnny's part. It, you know, Dave doesn't know how to operate the damn. See, this is one reason why Johnny does all the really intricate stuff, John, and I do all the simple stuff, like flip the switch on the microphone.
Listen, I wanted to tell you one story that I left out of the Mogadishu.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Thing.
Do you want Kenny G accompaniment or no?
No.
Okay.
Kenny G. Man, Kenny G. He's just a pain in my ass.
Well,
how he ends his tunes? It's like, you know, I was taking a piss the other day, you know, and when you shake it, especially when you get older, you know, there's always one f***ing last drop, and dribble, 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 dribble. That's how Kenny G ends his song. I mean, you think you're at the f***ing end, and he adds one or two more notes. Kenny, give it up. We don't give a stop. Just stop it. End the tune. I don't want to hear anything more. I'll give him the clap by proxy, too.
I was going to say, we'll leave that to Adam West.
I'll stick that on Batman. I'll stick Batman on him.
We're going to burn in hell with this show. We're going to burn in hell.
The Batman franchise is going to be suing us soon.
Can we do a disclaimer? The Above Network LLC would like to say that the opinions of John Leary concerning giving Batman the clap are his and his alone, and are not necessarily endorsed by the ATS Mix Show, Dave personally, Johnny personally, or anybody affiliated with the Above TopSecret.com network. Okay, John, go ahead and tell the rest of your story.
We were called, the guys that flew out of Budapest were called the Mystery Crew. And the reason we're called the Mystery Crew is because there was an article in the Saudi Gazette on Wednesday, October 26, 1977. And I'm just going to read you the story. It says, obviously I've got a copy of it. Mystery 707 flies arms to Somalia. A mystery Boeing 707 airliner, apparently loaded with arms, has landed at Mogadishu Airport on each of the last 3 days, diplomatic sources said yesterday. One European airline executive said the tail was painted yellow, but beneath the coat of paint, an emblem of the West German charter airline Condor could be seen. He said he saw Somali soldiers unloading chests of the kind used for packing light arms and ammunition. Condor is a charter company operated by the West German airline Lufthansa, one of whose airplanes was hijacked to Mogadishu last week before being successfully recaptured by a special West German force. And it's Dateline Reuters. So anyway, I have a picture I've posted several times on ATS of the Mystery Crew, and it's all of us together in downtown Budapest, standing in a parking lot or there.
Maybe you could send that to Dave and I so that we can post it on this thread.
Yeah, do you have a picture of it?
Yeah, I've got it all. I posted all this stuff before, but I could just send it to you. I'll just send it to you. Where do you want it to come to?
Dave or John? Where you email me all the time, Dave.
And your name is Dave?
Okay. Duh.
Yeah, don't send it to Adam West at ATSMIC. It won't get there.
Adam West at ATSMIC.
Mystery Man. Oh, boy.
Oh, Christ. We're going to all bring
it up. You know, my French wife was so beautiful.
Yeah.
The problem is she f***ed every single one of my friends. I mean, I didn't have one friend that she didn't f***. And I'm 65. It's been 45 years. I'm still finding people that she f***. And while we were married,
wow,
she didn't miss anybody, not anybody.
Well, fortunately, Dave and I are way down at the bottom of the list there, brother, so it won't happen in our lifetime.
Yeah, I'm afraid she's going to miss Dave and Johnny.
Hey, John, have you ever thought about documenting some of these stories in a book form? Man, I mean, this would be great reading, brother.
If I put it on paper, and then I'm not, you know, then you can't change it to the way you want it, you know. And I like to modify the stories every once in a while.
Duh. All right, John. Well, listen, we really appreciate the time. I don't know how we could possibly end any better, but we would like to thank our sponsor for the John Lear ATS Mix Conspiracies and the CIA Stories. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Kenny G. Thanks, Kenny, for being such a great supporter of John Lear and his chronicles for the CIA. So until next time of the John Lear Saga of the CIA, I'm Dave Rabbit.
And I'm John Lear.
And I'm John Lear.
And on behalf of Kenny G, John Lear, and John Lear, thanks for tuning in to this edition of the ATS Mix.
You know, Dave, I'm going to stuff Kenny G up your ass.
Hi, everybody. Dave Rabbit here with the ATS Mix Show from AboveTopSecret.com. When I get ready to relax after doing a long show, I enjoy going to our sister site, BelowTopSecret.com. They have some great forums there, some of which include rants, jokes, puns, and pranks, which is one of my favorites, faith and spirituality, relationships, travel and vacations. They even have a freshman forum for you newbies and rookies. I especially enjoy the music, television, fantasy, and science fiction forums, as well as comics, music, member art, and of course video games. But my absolute all-time favorite is cool websites. And I want to tell you why. As everyone knows, I do not read. On cool websites, the membership at BelowTopSecret.com has done the work for me. They've researched the World Wide Web and found very interesting sites. All I got to do, go into the forum, click, and I am at an interesting and very cool website. So when you get through listening to that last ATS Mix show, come join me at BelowTopSecret.com, part of the Above Network LLC. Remember, deny boredom, BelowTopSecret.com.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.abovetopsecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. We'll be right back.